Okay, so this is September 15th, 2012. Okay, we'll start with the salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, today we'll be taking sutta number 82 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Ratapala Sutta. I should mention that the name of this chapter of the Majjhima Nikaya is called the Division on Kings. You might have noticed that, Rajabhaga. What's rather interesting is that in at least several of these suttas, kings play a rather minor role. So it seems that the principle that the compilers of the Majjhima Nikaya went by in grouping the suttas into this chapter was that even if there is a mention of a king, whenever there's a mention of a king, even if it's in a relatively minor role, that still will explain the collection of that sutta into this chapter. So we saw last week when we took the Gatikara Sutta that really the main focus of the sutta is on the potter Gatikara. But it's just because a king comes in a partial role later in the sutta that the sutta is classified under the heading of kings. It seems that if I were responsible for the compilation, I might have put that sutta under the chapter dealing with householders. I think that's in the 50s in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Ratapala Sutta I would have put under the chapter dealing with bhikkhus, since the main sort of protagonist of the sutta is the man who becomes a monk. Okay, so let us start with the sutta. Okay, the sutta begins when the Buddha has been traveling in the Kuru country together with a large number of monks, and then he eventually arrives at a Kuru town named Tula Kotita. Now, now the Kuru country is located pretty much where Uttara Pradesh is now. It is the area where Delhi is the center of the Kuru country. So it's a bit far from where the Buddha usually would travel, which was in the eastern part of India, in the state of Kosala, which is to the northeast, and the state of Magadha, which corresponds to contemporary Bihar, which is in lower down in the east. Okay, so this is a little bit distant from the Buddha's usual, the place where the Buddha usually set out on his tours. Okay, so when the Buddha arrives at this town of Tula Kotita, then it's interesting that it refers to the Brahmin householders of Kuli Tutita herd, that this recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, has arrived at our town, and then they report what they've heard, the reputation of him. And this is a standard passage which collects the 9 epithets of the Buddha, that he is an accomplished or an arahat, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Here I would translate Sugata as the fortunate one, or the one who has gone to the good, the knower of the worlds, the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, the teacher of gods and human beings, the enlightened one, and the Bhagava, the blessed one, the exalted one. He teaches the nature of this world with all of its beings, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge, and he teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals the holy life or spiritual life that is utterly perfect or complete and pure. And so, after discussing the reputation of the recluse Gotama, they decide to go see him. And so they come, and they pay homage to him. Some just do anjali, some just greet him in a friendly way. Others just sit down silently, waiting to hear what he has to say. And so the Buddha then gives a discourse to the people. And in this group of householders who have come to listen to the Buddha, there is one young man, he's called a clansman, by the name of Ratapala. And he's said to be the son of the leading clan in Tulakotita. So he's not just a very ordinary person, but this is the elite, the aristocrats of that township. And as he's sitting there listening to the Buddha's discourse, then he thinks to himself that as I understand the Dharma taught by the Blessed One is not easy while living at home, or living the home life, to lead the brahmacharya, the holy life, which is utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the kasaya, kasayani vatani. It's not really yellow, but it's a kind of brownish stained color, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. So why isn't it easy to live, to lead the spiritual life completely perfect and pure while living at home?
Do we have time for answers?
Excuse me?
Do we have time for all the answers?
Let's get some. I mean, I've been a monk now for almost 40 years, so I've forgotten what it's like to live at home. Just having nagging parents is all I remember.
So for 1 month, that's when I'm forced to pay a mortgage or to pay a rent?
Okay, wait until we get the microphone so we can get you down. So everybody around the world can hear what you have to say. Okay, anybody else have any?
I'm grateful for my house.
Don't be shy. Nobody has any ideas. We're going to stage an ordination later today.
Okay, you can hear me?
Yeah.
One of the things is when you're out there, there's a lot of cravings that bombard you, and it's hard to overcome them. They're always at you.
All these?
They're always there. They're always coming at you.
Yeah.
And so I guess if you could go into a monastery and live a more reclusive life for a while, you can be trained in your concentration, which will then lead to wisdom. Easier to realize that there is a better life. But it's hard to let go of all those
Yeah. Okay. So basically, what she says is that when one is living the home life, one is constantly bombarded by, let's say, different provocations which arouse craving, and then it's hard to let go of those cravings. Okay, Richard. But first, Clement.
In our daily life, you also. Exposed to a lot of unwise attentions. You know, our six faculties, you know, the things that we see, a lot of those things, you know, arouse, you know, greed, hatred, and defilement.
Yeah.
Things we hear, you know, people talk, music, gossip.
Yeah.
You know, the things that we smell,
yeah.
taste, it, you know, like what she mentioned, craving
for,
you know, things. So, you know, it's tough to prevent all of this in our daily lives.
Okay, so he says that when one is living in the household life, then one is disposed to pay unwise attention to the objects of the six senses, and then these provoke greed, anger, delusion. Okay, then Richard was going to take the microphone.
Conventional life depends upon our standard of hypocrisy.
Depends on?
On hypocrisy's being standard. That is, people have relationships with people who have are supposed to have more or less esteem than they do and more or less power and so on. And so you're supposed to treat the people who are supposed to be your superiors differently from the way you're supposed to treat the people who are supposed to be your inferiors. So you're supposed to flatter the people above you and obey them and respect them, and you're supposed to disrespect the people below you and scorn them and humiliate them.
Yeah.
This makes normal people quite hypocritical. And so they say one kind of thing in one situation, to one person, a totally different kind of thing to somebody else in another situation. So normal life prevents the unification of the self.
Okay. So what he says is that living in the household life, one has to behave in different ways to different people according to their, you know, relative social position, and that leads to hypocrisy, sycophancy, you know, having to praise and glorify others, scorning others, and so one is not able to unify oneself. Anybody else have any ideas?
In the later household life, you look for happiness in things that, with desires that really cannot provide true happiness. When you renounce those things and you live in a monastery, you try to find happiness in meditations, in things that will bring you true liberation.
Yeah. Okay, so basically he says that when one is living in a household life, how did you put that again? The key point. Just the key point.
We look for true happiness in things that cannot provide.
Oh yeah. One looks for true happiness in things that cannot provide real happiness. Does anybody have any kids? Little ones.
I have friends who do.
Yeah.
And depending on the age of the children, it can make even meditation almost impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, you can teach little children to sit in your lap while you're sitting, but it can be a very real issue. And kids need when they need.
Yeah. Okay, so there are a whole variety of things that sort of obstructions, difficulties, impediments, temptations. But I also have to say, very frankly, that quite a few of them arise also in the monastic life. Don't form ideal images of monasteries and monastic life and monks and nuns.
I do volunteer work at the Danbury Women's Prison.
Yeah.
And I used to be accompanied by a bhikkhuni who let the women know that she actually kind of, she envied them in a way, because it, from her point of view, they weren't as taken up by all the chores of working in a monastery and keeping going.
Yeah.
And they were freer to have a spiritual life in prison.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've known quite a few monks who always sort of shake their heads and say, just too much work to meditate, not enough time. And then within the monastery also you find monks who are in high position and tend to oppress those in lower positions. And one finds monks who become hypocrites and flatterers in order to win the favor of, you know, that maybe the chief monk or the abbot, he wants to get close to the abbot, so he'll flatter the abbot to become chosen as the abbot's personal attendant, and then he can lord it over the other monks. One finds quarrels and disputes. You see, even in the Majjhima Nikaya, a few occasions, the Sangha became so bitterly divided that they wouldn't even listen to the Buddha when the Buddha tried to reconcile the quarreling factions. Okay, so let us continue. Okay, so now, after the Buddha's, while the Buddha is speaking, apparently Ratapala is thinking in this way, and so he will wait until when the discourse is over. He waits, you know, hanging around just maybe quietly in the back till all of the other householders pay their homage to the Buddha and then depart. And so when they leave, when the Buddha is maybe just sitting up there alone, maybe with a monk or two attending on him, then the clansman Ratapala comes up to the Buddha and he tells the Buddha what he's been thinking. And then he expresses the wish. He says, Bhante, Venerable Sir, I wish to shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. I would receive the going forth under the Blessed One. I would receive the full admission or the full ordination. Okay, so now the Buddha asks him an important question. He says, have you gotten the permission of your parents to go forth from the home life into homelessness? And Ratapala says, no, Venerable Sir, I haven't received my parents' permission. And then the Buddha says, Ratapala, Tathagatas, again, to remember from last week, he's sort of generalizing this, maybe to emphasize that this is a universal, a very binding principle. Tathagatas do not give the going forth to anyone who does not have his parents' permission. Now, do you know the story about the Buddha's going forth? The Buddha's great renunciation. Did the Buddha have the permission of his parents? No. And then, later, after his enlightenment, the Buddha came back to visit Kapalavattu, and then he gave the going forth to his own son. His own son was 7 years old at the time, and so he couldn't become a fully ordained monk, but the Buddha admitted him as a novice, a samanera. So in a sense, you could say Rahula, the Buddha's son, had not only the Buddha's permission, but he was ordained on the instructions of the Buddha. But after the Buddha instructed Sariputta to ordain Rahula, then the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, came to the Buddha somewhat heart-stricken and said, "Bhante, you know, it was very difficult for me when you disappeared from the palace and became an ascetic. And now I was putting like all of my hopes on your only son, Rahula, to become the leader of the Sakyas. And now Rahula has become a monk. So please, I want to make a request of you." The Buddha said, "What is your request?" And he said, "Please make a rule that nobody should be ordained without the parents' permission." But something a little bit strange has happened in the way the Vinaya has been compiled, in that the question, "Do you have your parents' permission?" only comes up when somebody is taking the full ordination as a bhikkhu, which means that he's 20 years of age or older. And so before the ordination, they ask a series of questions, and one of the questions is, "Do you have your parents' permission to become a monk?" Or in the case of a nun, of a woman, to become a bhikkhuni, to become a fully ordained nun. But in the case of for the novice ordination, the question isn't asked. And so somebody can become a novice, even if they're, you know, 20 years old or older, they can become a novice monk without the parents' permission. You know, as though the parents are going to be able to distinguish, you know, if you say, "Oh, he's not fully ordained, he's not a bhikkhu," but there he is, the kid standing there with his head shaved, wearing the ochre robes, living in a monastery, maybe studying or meditating full time. You know, the parents is not going to say, "Oh, I didn't realize there was a distinction of novices and fully ordained monks. I understand, I accept it." But the parent will say, "Doesn't make any difference to me. I want him at home, dressed like a normal human being, working in the office or studying to become a doctor or lawyer or engineer or scientist or teacher or whatever." And then what is done, like in a country in Sri Lanka, I remember that there was a Greek monk who had come, had been ordained. His parents were very much against his ordination, so he didn't get the actual permission from his parents. And so he remained a novice for maybe 4 or 5 years, something like that. But he wanted to take the full ordination. And so what they do is, you know, not legally, but they say, "Okay, what we're going to do is to assign you to this pious Buddhist couple who will be your Dharma parents." You go to them, you know, maybe they bring them together and introduce. "Okay, George, this is Mr. and Mrs. Wanasuriya, they are your Dhamma parents. Mr. and Mrs. Wanasuriya, this is George, he will be your Dhamma son." So George then asks Mr. and Mrs. Wanasuriya, "My Dhamma parents, may I receive ordination?" And they will say, "Wonderful, wonderful, sadhu, sadhu. We will provide you with your robes, your alms bowl, let us offer you your first meal after your ordination, we'll cover the expenses of the ordination." So then George will come back to his teacher. The teacher will say, "Do you have your parents' permission?" And he'll say, "Yes," because now he's gotten the permission from the Dharma parents. Okay, so continuing. Okay. Okay, so the Buddha says that he doesn't give the going forth. But this is, you see, this is what the Buddha is saying here. That he doesn't give the going forth. The going forth means the novice ordination. Allowing somebody to leave the home life and take up the life of a monk, even without the full ordination. So I don't give the going forth to anyone without the parents' permission. So then Ratapala says, I will see to it that my parents permit me to go forth into homelessness. Okay, so then Ratapala gets up, he goes to his parents and he tells them that I've listened to the Dharma of the wandering ascetic Gotama, the Blessed One, and I want to live the spiritual life under him. So please give me permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness. And then Ratapala's parents reply, you know, they're not delighted at all. Probably they are followers of the Brahminic religion. They're not very, maybe they don't have a very friendly attitude towards the samanas, the wandering ascetics. And of course, they, like most normal parents, they deeply love Ratapala, and especially in an Indian family, he's not just their child, but he is their only son. So in this respect, the Indians are very much like Jewish parents, like probably Chinese parents also. If you have only one son and he wants to go forth and become a monk, unless the parents are, if the parents are devout Buddhists, then of course they'll permit it. But if their followers, they have just the mainstream Chinese religion, you know, mainly Confucianism with a little Taoism and Buddhist ceremonies when you pass away for the funeral, then probably they'll refuse. Okay, so the parents say, "You're our only son. Dear and beloved, you've been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You know nothing of suffering." Now, this is quite remarkable that Ratapala is, apparently he's 20 years or older because he becomes a bhikkhu, fully ordained, immediately. And yet they say, probably in a well-placed Indian family, a quite wealthy Indian family, the child is brought up in like the lap of luxury, especially if he's the only son or the only child. You know, they don't have to spend other things on other, their wealth on other children. So he gets things, and the way parents dote on their only child, they give him everything that he wants. And so he's brought up with the parents doing everything to ensure that their only son is happy and content. And yet under those conditions, this young man is, you know, he must have been somebody whose faculties have been matured in samsara. And so immediately that he hears the Buddha's teaching, so he realizes that life in the world is full of dukkha or suffering, and wants to go forth to put an end to suffering. But still the parents are pleading with him, and they were to say, even if you were to die, we wouldn't be willing to lose you. So how could we give you permission to go forth while you're still alive? So Ratapala requests permission from his parents the second time, the third time. The third time the parents refuse. So when they refuse three times, Ratapala is still determined, still his mind is set on going forth. Anything within the worldly life probably seems hollow and empty and pointless to him. And so right there, right on that occasion, he just sits down or lies down on the floor and says, either you give me the going forth while I'm lying here, or I'll die. Probably, though the text doesn't say this, he might even have gone on what we call a hunger strike. He says, I won't accept any meals while I'm here. In fact, if he continues to accept the meals, it seems unlikely that he'll die, right? He'll just be sitting there. Of course, it'll get a little boring, and maybe he'll have to get up to stretch the limbs to avoid discomfort. But probably the decisive factor would be refusing food and water. Okay, so now the parents, again, they plead with him, and then they tell him, get up, dear Ratapala, eat. Yeah, this indicates that Ratapala must have refused to eat and drink, because they say, get up, dear Ratapala, eat, drink, and amuse yourself. While eating, drinking, and amusing yourself, you can be happy, enjoying sensual pleasures, and making merit, doing meritorious deeds. So here we see a kind of split or conflict between two ways of living a good life. Okay, one way of life is the ordinary good life. You know, the parents are not enjoining him to lead a bad life, but you could lead a good life, you know, get married, have children, bring up a family, get a good job, and you can do, you'll inherit our wealth, and with the wealth you can do deeds of merit. You can observe precepts, you can perhaps sponsor rituals and ceremonies by the Brahmins to get merit, since they're probably followers of Brahmanism. You can make offerings to the wandering ascetics. You could do many good deeds which will bring merit. So that's one possibility called the mundane path of meritorious deeds. And the other path is the path of renunciation aimed at liberation. And that will be the path of observing strict precepts, observing including celibacy, undertaking the life of a wandering ascetic, perhaps undertaking some of the ascetic practices, and especially devoting oneself to the practice of meditation to gain insight and to break the bonds of birth and death. And so, again, they refuse to give him permission, and this exchange goes on, you know, three times. So then Ratapala's parents are still not ready to give up, so they go to his friends and they ask his friends to go to Ratapala and plead with him to give up this foolish idea of starving himself to death and try to convince him that he could enjoy himself and do meritorious deeds. So the friends go to Ratapala, they plead with him on behalf of the parents, they try to persuade him to enjoy himself and do meritorious deeds. But again, each time, three times, Ratapala just sits there, remaining silent. So finally, Ratapala's friends come to the parents and say that, you know, Ratapala is very serious about this. It's impossible for us to break his will. He's determined to go forth. So really, the choice, he seems set on either dying right there or receiving your permission. So it's better that you give him your permission. That way he'll continue to live. And certainly, if he becomes a monk, he'll come back to visit you from time to time, and so you'll get to see him. Okay, so in this way, finally, the Ratapala's parents relent on their refusal to give permission, and they tell the friends that we now give Ratapala permission to go forth, but after he's become a monk, he has to return from time to time to visit us. So the friends go back to Ratapala, report this, and so Ratapala gets up, and then after he regains his strength, apparently this Ratapala has remained sitting there, lying there, perhaps for several days, because it says he has to regain his strength, so probably has to start resume taking meals in order to recover his strength. So then he goes to the Buddha and he tells the Buddha, "Now, Bhante, I've gotten my parents' permission, so please give me the going forth." And so thereupon, Ratapala receives the going forth from the Blessed One. That is, he becomes admitted first as a novice, and then probably maybe even the same day or shortly afterwards, he receives the full ordination. He becomes a bhikkhu. Okay, and then the text tells us that not long after Venerable Ratapala had received the full admission, a half month after he had received the full admission, the Blessed One set out to wander to Savatthi, and wandering by stages, he eventually arrived at Savatthi and stayed at the Jetas Grove and Atapindika's park. And apparently Ratapala probably went along with the Buddha. So right after his ordination, Ratapala didn't go to visit his parents. And then the texts tell us, not before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Ratapala, by realizing it for himself, here and now entered upon and dwelt in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. And he knew that birth is finished, the cycle of rebirths is finished, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to back to any state of being. And so Ratapala had become one of the arhats. The text says here in section 14, before long dwelling alone, or not long afterwards, but the commentary says that what is meant by before long is 12 years. So Ratapala had to stay under a teacher to learn the Dhamma, to rehearse the Dhamma that he had learned till he was able to retain it in mind. And then he had to go off into solitude and practice meditation diligently for 12 years. And then he realized the supreme goal. And even though it might seem a bit far-fetched for the commentary to be explaining before long as 12 years, we see later in the sutta that there might be some justification for that explanation. Okay, so after Ratapala becomes an arahat, then he goes to the Buddha and he sits down and he tells the Buddha, "Bhante, I now want to go to visit my parents. I had assured them when I went forth that I would come to visit them from time to time. They must be very worried about me. They haven't seen me for such a long time. And you know the way parents worry. And in those days, it seems writing was not used for personal communications, and so there couldn't have been exchanges of letters between them." So he's asking the Blessed One, "Please give me permission to go see my parents." And now the Buddha probably thought that if Ratapala had not yet achieved arhatship, or at least the stage of Sreemantra, he might have been subject to falling back from the monastic life. That if Ratapala's parents tried to tempt him in various ways, he might be vulnerable, there might still be some weak spots in his heart, and so the parents might have been able to win him over and bring him back to the household life. So the Buddha then makes the determination to examine Ratapala's mind with his own mind to see where his mind is at. And so when he does this, then the Buddha knows, you know, directly through super knowledge, he knows that Ratapala has eradicated all of the defilements and gained full liberation. And so therefore he's incapable of abandoning the training and returning to the household life. And so the Buddha gives permission to Ratapala to go to visit his parents. Okay, so then Ratapala packs his things, sets his dwelling place in order, and then he gradually wanders from Savati to his hometown of Tulakotita. And when he arrives in Tulakotita, he sets up his dwelling place, or he comes to dwell in this Migachira garden. It's the game garden, the garden where the deer and other animals are dwelling. And so then one morning, perhaps it was the morning after he arrives there, he dresses and he takes his alms bowl and his outer robe and goes into the town on alms round. And he's wandering for alms from house to house. And obviously he was intending to go to his parents' house. So then he's coming to his parents' house. And on that occasion, his father was sitting in a hall that would be probably like the porch in a modern house. He's having his hair combed. Of course, in those days, the people would have long hair. And so he probably has like a servant brushing his hair, putting oil on it. Okay, so then the father sees Ratapala, or he sees this monk coming in the distance. And then he thinks to himself, or maybe he speaks to the servant, and he says, "My own son, my own dear and beloved only son, was made to become a monk by those bald-pated recluses, those baldy-headed recluses." Remember, we came across the statement, what was it, last week or a couple of weeks ago? It was last week. It was Sutta 81. And this was the way the Brahmins would speak about the Buddhists, or about any of these samanas, the ascetics, in a rather scornful way. So apparently his father didn't recognize Ratapala. He just saw this figure coming towards him, you know, with a shaved head, with an ochre-colored robe. And he couldn't identify Ratapala, but all he thought was that this must be one of the members of that, one of the henchmen of that ascetic Gotama who was here many years ago. And those guys, they don't have any concern for our children. They just draft them as though they're like a king drafting a young man into the army. And so when this wandering ascetic came to the house of this eminent family of Tulakotita, the father didn't give alms, but just abused them and said, "Get away from here, you rascal, good-for-nothing beggar, you wandering ascetic. Get away, we don't want you here." Okay, so Ratapala is trained. It's a bit strange that, he's come back to visit his parents. And so one would think, if it were a normal child, if I were in that situation, I would look up and say, "Father, Dad, don't you recognize me?" Then father would have said, "Oh, Ratapala, I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. Come in. But for some reason, Ratapala doesn't say that. He just, maybe he's training to bear the situation patiently. Any other ideas? Why doesn't he address his father? Any ideas? Is it? Do you have the microphone? Okay.
Maybe he expected this, because I think that he knew from his childhood that his family was so averse to his going forth that they would not, after 12 years, recognize him, and that they did not respect monks generally, but that they held an enormous grievance.
Yeah.
And so I think he... and probably, my guess is also he probably felt at that time that in order to maintain his position as a monk, and he could not reveal to his family who he was, because he felt he changed identity. That is, he could not appeal for special treatment from his family. Once he had done what he knew his family didn't want him to do, then he effectively disowned his family. So he
disowned him. Yeah, but still, he came back to Tulakotita with the intention of visiting his parents, because his parents, when he left, had requested that he come back to visit them, and so one would expect him to get some kind of greeting from the parents. I should tell you at least one incident in my own life. When I became a monk in Sri Lanka, and I lived in Sri Lanka for 5 years, then after 5 years I thought I should come back to visit my parents, and so I told them I would come back to visit them. And I arrived back at the airport. This was John F. Kennedy Airport. Now, this is what I learned from my father afterwards, that I was coming down some steps, or maybe coming out the door in the arrivals building. I didn't see what had happened, but my father told me later that my parents had seen me before I saw them. And so when I became visible to them, my mother had said to my father, "That's not our son. Let's go home." But my father said to my mother, "Yes, he's our son, we have to accept him." Okay. Katie, were you going?
So why he didn't tell his parents? Maybe if his practice has gone far enough along that he no longer has a sense of coming in, the desire for coming into being, so his relationship
No longer
has a desire for coming into being, or has that aspect is gone. So it's not that he's rude, it's just that his relationship to his own parents has changed and become very cleansed.
Yeah, but still I would still think that, you know, the relationship with the parents has changed that much, you know, so if there's a total break, then he wouldn't go to visit them.
But they requested, yes.
Well, they requested, and so he's going at their request, so, you know, he wouldn't really be fulfilling their request if he comes back and then, without revealing himself to them, he just goes back to Sabati to visit the Buddha, or to stay with the Buddha. He can't then think, "Well, I went to see my parents, but they just drove me away." Asma, did you have something?
I was going to say, something similar to what she said, right now, my understanding is that he's an Amana. And he treated that situation with equanimity.
Yep.
He didn't respond.
Yeah, I mean, he had
one way or the other.
Yeah, he showed equanimity, but in my view, one could show equanimity by saying, "Father, I'm your son. You wanted me to come back, so now I've come."
Along with the equanimity, I've thought of the phrase "first things first," and he's on his alms rounds. And I see him figuring that he'd deal with them later.
That's a very good idea. That's a very good suggestion. Yeah, that's really good. Like, now he's on the alms round, so he has to complete the alms round. And so probably he's maybe thinking, okay, let me collect my food from the different houses. When I have enough, I'll go off, take my meal, then I'll come back at a later time. You wrong hand her hand up.
I was going to say it's almost the same answer. Alms Run, but I don't know if there's any rule. If you go to a house on Alms Run and you get refused, can you open your mouth and say something so that people give you food? As a monk,
normally it doesn't do that.
Right, so I think in this case, Alms Run, if he opens his mouth and I'm your son, then he say, okay, you should give me food because
I'm
your son. Or I'm a teacher, or I'm a good person. It just not the right moment.
Yeah, very, very good. I think you're both, Barbara and Yurong, have put your fingers on the point.
The next paragraph, the slave.
Okay, I'll take that. I don't want you to mention it before we go through it. I think I know what you're going to say, but we'll come to it. Okay. Okay, now we continue. This is interesting. What comes next? Okay, just then a slave woman belonging to one of his relatives was about to throw away some old porridge, stale porridge. This would probably have been some rice gruel, rice porridge from the previous evening. Because now Ratapala is walking for alms in the morning. So when Ratapala saw this, probably he had passed by the veranda or porch. Do we use the word veranda in English?
Veranda. It's pronounced a little differently, but yes, especially in the south.
In the south, okay. We use the word Elmira. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what that means. I'm from the south. Elmira's a town near where I grew up. Elmira, what does that mean? It's a town now.
Almira.
Okay.
No, we don't use it. Okay, these are what I call Singlish terms that I picked up in Sri Lanka. I thought veranda is one. They never say porch, but it's veranda. Then Elmira is like a cabinet. We would call it a cabinet, right? We would put it in the Elmira. Okay, so the father is sitting out on the porch or in like the front room, and since he's rejected Ratapala has passed him by, and maybe there's like a sort of side door of the house which the servants use, but not the masters of the house. And so now the servant is out, the slave woman is out that side door, about to throw away that old porridge. And then Ratapala sees her and says to her, if that stuff is to be thrown away, then just put it here in my bowl. I mean, normally as the monk, we don't request people to give food, but probably in this case, because Ratapala sees that she's going to throw it away, so rather than just waste it, put it in my alms bowl. Okay, now, while she is doing so, she's putting the porridge in the bowl, maybe using a ladle to scoop it out and put it in the bowl. She recognizes the characteristic features of Ratapala's hands, his feet, and she heard his voice. And so she realizes that this mendicant monk who's come to the house, this is none other than the master's son, Ratapala. You know, she goes to the mother and she says, you should know, my lady, that the young master, Ratapala, has arrived. Now, isn't it a bit peculiar that the father didn't recognize Ratapala? You know, the father, but the slave woman recognizes him. How do we explain this? Okay, take the microphone, Barbara.
The father, even from afar, was reacting rather than responding.
Yeah.
He didn't take time to take in
yeah.
what was really going on.
Yeah.
He was going to
mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the slave was interacting with him in the process of giving the porridge.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's possible that the father's mind was just so overcome, overwhelmed by anger and resentment, yet so that he didn't even register the facial features of the monk coming towards him. But he just, you know, the way we impose categories on people. You know, he just sees this figure in the distance coming towards him, and just the category, a monk follower of Gotama, has come. Those are wretched people, rascals, despicable. Then he sees he's coming to my house, he's going to be begging from me. Get out of here, get out, we don't want you.
Yeah, it's a good example of the effect of the hindrances, like a pot of water that is boiling. His father's so angry he can't be working as a son, but as Barbara said, the servant.
Yeah, maybe you're wrong, has some idea.
I still look at this as a plot of the story.
Yeah.
Because the father is the Brahman, and the slave is at the lowest level. And then so they're putting the appearance of the monk at the level of the slave. So the father, still in his Brahman's mind, wouldn't look at the monk just like he would look at a slave.
Hmm.
Really, trying to think about what the characters in the story is thinking about.
Or what?
Rather than trying to figure out what the characters in the story they're thinking about.
Yeah.
I think we should look at the mind of the person writing the story.
Yeah, though I have to say that I don't get the impression that Ratapala's family is a Brahmin family, even though the beginning it describes the Tulakotita as the Brahmin householders of Kulatotita go to hear the Buddha preach. But if somebody in the Buddhist text, if somebody is, you know, a real staunch member of the Brahmin clan who's living the Brahmin way of life, he's always described as the Brahmin so-and-so, or sometimes as just the Brahmin. When they describe somebody as like the householder rather than Brahmin, it suggests that they're not from the Brahmin class, but from the class of the Gahapatis, the householders.
But anyway, the contrast is he's trying to bribe his son with women and wealth.
Okay, we'll come to that. We have to avoid like what they call spoilers.
Actually, I'm not surprised because I think it's quite common in a wealthy family. They may hire, you know, slaves or servants to take care of the younger generation.
Exactly. That was just one of the things I was thinking of. You know, sometimes I have to go into Manhattan for various reasons. And what strikes me when I'm walking through, you know, residential parts of Manhattan, sometimes I see this on Long Island, there'll be a little white baby, but in a stroller or a carriage, and the woman, sometimes I've seen this on the subway trains also, the woman taking care of the little baby will be dark-skinned. Either African American or somebody from maybe coming from like the Philippines or Latino South America. And so now it's become customary, I guess, or common in like wealthy, fairly well-to-do families, probably because the man is working, the mother is working, so they'll hire a woman to come and look after and bring up the child. And so I see like the child sometimes I've seen is like hugging the, you call it the servant woman, or the, what's the special name for the woman who takes care of the child?
Nanny.
The nanny, hugging the nanny. And I've even seen situations where there are a few of them sitting together. The woman who looks like the child is like, obviously, I infer that's the mother, and the nanny is holding the child, and the child is hugging the nanny, not the mother. As though the child feels more affection for the nanny than for the biological mother. So probably, you know, in this case too, it was always the slave woman who was taking care and bringing up Ratapala. So the mother, because she might have been like high class, and so she wouldn't do such lowly tasks as breastfeeding the child, but give it to the slave woman, having to change the child's diapers, having to dress the child, bring the child up, just, you know, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The child comes, sits with the family, and then goes off, and maybe even the slave woman is the one who plays with the child, gives the child toys. Okay, so the slave woman then comes and she reports this to... Oh, was there a question in the back? Oh, I see, this is... You ask your question, then I will see whether it's going to be a spoiler or...
The next sentence, the mother said, gracious, if what you said is true, you are no longer a slave.
Yeah.
But I want to know why, when she recognizes that's her son, why the mother said, once you recognize he is my son, you are no longer a slave. Why? Why she say that?
Okay.
Why she changed her status from slave, no longer a slave?
Yeah, I mean, this was done in India. First, India at the time, the time of the Buddha, apparently slavery was quite commonplace. I don't think it was a cruel slave system in which the masters, the way we have slavery depicted in the South, where they would beat the slaves and force them to work exceedingly long hours. But it was just part of the established social, institution. But there were a fair number of cases mentioned in the Vinaya, as well as a few other suttas, where slave owners, if the slave will do something especially beneficial to the family, or to the master, they will give the slave their freedom. We find this in the description of the five hindrances, where one of the hindrances is compared to slavery. And then they speak about the slave being freed and then being able to go wherever he wants. So it was a quite common practice for people to release their slaves. Okay, so then Ratapala's mother goes to the father and tells him that she just says that the clansman Ratapala has arrived. Apparently, at least according to the text, she doesn't tell him that the wandering monk that you chased away was Ratapala. But just then it says that the Venerable Ratapala was sitting by the wall of a certain shelter. It might have been a kind of shelter built within the town for wanderers, people wandering and traveling. So he was leaning against that wall, eating the food he had collected on alms round, including the old porridge. Somehow the father knows that he's eating old porridge, which is, I have to say, that seems a little bit like a literary interpolation. How would the father know that he has the old porridge in his alms bowl?
The slave told him. The slave.
Perhaps. But it seems a little bit too convenient to make an interesting story. Okay, so the father goes to him and then says, now he's speaking sweet, sugary words. He says, Ratapala, my dear, surely there is, and in the Pali text it seems like the sentence is cut off here, And the commentary explains, how does the commentary know this? I don't know. But the commentary says that the father meant to say that there is wealth in our home, but because the father was overwhelmed by emotion, he couldn't complete the sentence. And so he says, surely there is, then his voice gets choked by emotion, and then he just blurts out, and you'll be eating old porridge. Can't you come to your own house to eat? Okay, and then Ratapala replies and says, how could we have a householder when we have gone forth from the home life into homelessness? We are homeless ones, householder. We, and this is what's called the royal plural, and I went to your house, but I didn't receive any alms food from you, nor did I receive a polite refusal. Polite refusal, that means sometimes, like if a Buddhist monk will come to a home and the family doesn't have any food prepared, so the people will come out and say, oh, I'm sorry, venerable sir, but we didn't prepare any food yet for today. Can you wait a half hour while we prepare something? Then usually the monk will say, well, much merit to you for the thought, but we have to get back to the monastery, and they'll continue on the alms round. But here he didn't receive even this polite refusal, but instead he only received these rather aggressive, abusive words. So then the father now is probably rather embarrassed and ashamed of himself and feeling apologetic. So he says, come dear Ratapala, let's go to the house. Like now the father wants to compensate for the abuse that he rained on the head of poor Ratapala. But Ratapala now gives him a polite refusal and he says, enough householder, my meal for today is finished. Apparently, the father wanted to bring Ratapala to the house in order to offer him food. So now the father invites Ratapala to come to accept his meal for the next day. And Ratapala consents, the text says, in silence, probably by that polite gesture of sort of going like this. It's the way of consenting. Okay, so now the father has a scheme in his mind when he has invited Ratapala. So the father goes back to the house and he has the gold coins and the blocks of gold made into a large heap, and he covers this heap with coverlets, maybe blankets and mats. So the father is obviously going to try to tempt Ratapala. If he were a present-day father, maybe he would go to the automobile shop and buy a BMW or Mercedes and bring it back to the house and cover the car with a big cloak of some sort. Okay, and then the father goes to Ratapala's former wives and says, come, my daughters-in-law, adorn yourselves with ornaments in the way Ratapala found you most dear and lovable, that is, in the past when he was living at home. Does anything seem a little bit incongruent here? Something a little bit puzzling? Just speak with a loud voice. Oh, it's on.
It would seem that the father or the wives themselves will appeal to white power.
It seems
that the father,
yeah,
or the wives themselves would have appealed to white power before when he wanted permission, but they didn't speak about that at all.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, it would seem, this is where it seems a little bit odd that one would think that if Ratapala had been married, and since this is a wealthy family, as was customary in ancient India, for in a wealthy family, often the young man would have several wives, one would think that in the passage where that is relating how the parents tried to tempt Ratapala not to go forth and become a monk, they ask his friends to go to appeal to him. But there's no mention of the wives there. Richard?
Yeah.
Take the...
I suspect the reason for that was that it was the Hindu norm that the husband should be 1.5 times the age of the wife. He was 20 when he left. Mm. So his wives at the time would have been child brides. That is, they would have been, age 12 or so. And the mother-in-law would have treated them as vastly inferior.
Mm.
And also he would have been taught that he really shouldn't pay attention to them and so on. So they simply wouldn't have had enough status at the time that he was 20 to be able to have any effect on them.
That's possible, but if you said that the husband should be 1.5 times the age.
Yes, the bride is supposed to be 2/3 the age of the husband.
Yeah, so if the husband, if Ratapala is 20.
Well, then the bride should, they should have that, at that time, has been about 14.
Yeah. Now there's a big difference between 14 and, 8 or 10, in that at 14 they probably would have passed.
That's the time that he probably would have been married when he was about 18, and they at that time would have been about 12.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
12.
But
now, when he's 32, 12 years later, they're 24.
Yeah, yeah. But the text does say, adorn yourself with ornaments in the way Ratapala, apparently in the past, found you most dear and lovable, and this would imply a kind of sexual attraction.
Yeah.
It's not like behave like the little girls that Ratapala found very cute when he was living the household life.
Yeah.
Like 8-year-old girls, oh, so cute. But rather it's 14, 15-year-old girls, since it was quite normal for the man to be quite a few years older. If he's 20, he could still be sexually attracted and have sexual relations with them.
Yeah, well, they also, the wealthy household.
Yeah.
That is, the wives would have been wearing a lot of jewelry
from
a very early age.
Yeah.
Because it was normal for women to wear the wealth of the family.
Yeah.
So they would, they would have been part of their status as members of the household to have a lot of jewelry.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, did you have something to say? But I think the point that you made, that the women as the daughters-in-law would have been vastly inferior within the structure of Indian society, and so the parents would not have given much heed to them, and they might have thought that Ratapala would not give much heed to them. That's a possibility.
That's kind of what I was thinking, that really the role of women was not a high one.
Yeah.
In fact, earlier when they were talking of the slave comes to say that Ratapala is there, she refers to him as your son.
The Lord's son, yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't say your mother.
Yeah, he doesn't say to the mother, your son,
say your
but
son.
The Lord's,
she
my
says,
Lord's son.
The Lord's son. And I think here they wouldn't have, the wives would not have been felt to have the same status as the male friends.
Yes, yeah. Okay, Richard has some other comments?
Yeah, part of the reason for that is that in the Hindu system, men can be twice born. That is, They have.
Oh, that is true, yeah.
And women, nothing. Women were on the same status as shudras. They were once born people because they couldn't have gurus and they couldn't have the upanayana ceremony, and therefore also they couldn't own land. As it was understood that any wealth that they had actually belonged not to them, but to the husbands and fathers. And so it's when she says, the Lord's son has come back, is because all of the entire household revolves around the relationship between father and son.
Yeah.
And the father, you see, that also by Hindu law, the father cannot have a good rebirth unless his son prays for him.
Yeah.
The son is obligated to pray for the father's soul upon his deceased.
Yeah, that's also
for
very
years.
Yeah. But I wonder how actually the Shraddha rite is mentioned in Buddhist suttas. Yeah, so it already existed in the Buddhist time.
Yeah, and so this is part of the idea that he's the only son. So that means that he is the only son who is able to assure his father's rebirth.
Yeah.
So that once he becomes a monk, then the father also coming and says, okay, you can come back and visit. He concedes that point.
Yeah.
But once the son's a monk, essentially he's saying his son's dead to him. So he's not recognizing his son when his son returns, partly because it's like he's already written him off. Saying, okay, so you may return, but you are not fulfilling your civic or your religious obligations to me anymore. And so there's a disowning. The son is basically disowning the father, but the father in consequence is disowning his son. Now he's surprised that son comes back. Presumably, his wife or something may have thought for a long time that the son was going to be coming back, in a few months or in a year or something. But after 12 years, probably the family had given up. It's also, when Odysseus returns to Ithaca, the first person to recognize him is the nurse.
Yeah.
Right? And part of the thing is that is all, everyone presumes that Penelope is going on weaving and so on is this kind of false presumption because they don't believe anymore that he's coming back.
Yep. Okay, I want to move on. Sandy, did you have something to add?
I think we take
the microphone.
His wife, even when maybe she's a teenager when he left, and when he returned, he's already grown up. She's grown up already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the parents ask the wife to try to do something
to tempt him.
Yes. That's the appropriate age to do this.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let us continue. Okay, so now the next day, through the night, the father had good food of various kinds prepared in his own house. Then in the morning, he had the time, and he had sent somebody apparently to the park to announce the time to Venerable Ratapala to inform him the meal was ready. So then Ratapala dresses, takes his bowl and outer robe, goes to his father's house, and he sits down on the seat that's prepared for him. Then when Ratapala is seated, apparently maybe even trapped, so they have somebody like strong guards standing at the door, then the father removes the covering from that pile of gold coins and blocks of gold, and he says, "Dear Ratapala, this is your maternal fortune, one part of the heap. This is your paternal fortune, that's another part of the heap. And this is your ancestral fortune, another part of the heap. Dear Ratapala, you can enjoy the wealth and make merit." Again, that appeal to the possibility of leading a virtuous life in the world while doing deeds of merit. "And come, dear Ratapala, abandon the training and return to the lower life, that's the life in the world, enjoy the wealth and make merit. And now Ratapala speaks rather sternly to his father. He says to his father, first he addresses the father as householder rather than father. He says, householder, if you would follow my advice, have this pile of gold coins and bullion loaded on carts and carried away to be dumped midstream in the river Ganges. Why is that? Because on account of this gold, pile of gold, there will arise for you sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. What do you think of that saying? Okay, we'll just wait till the clanging is finished. Were you going to speak, John? Okay, you could hand the microphone back. I have to speak loudly because we have competition.
Obviously, the rivers were worshipped in India and the headwaters of the river, so maybe he's saying if you make merit.
No, I don't think it's a sacrificial offering to the river. Probably it's just that the river Ganges is flowing nearby. Okay, see who wants to speak.
Not seeing actually pain and suffering is, that's kind of what leads to want to delude themselves in like everything is good and
put the microphone close.
Oh, you know, not seeing pain and grief, you know, which is also part of the reality.
Yeah.
That's kind of what leads one to kind of delude oneself. Mm. Imagine that everything is always good.
Yeah.
So seeing this, it forces you to actually look for a solution that is beyond the ordinary things that are so temporary,
yeah,
that are not so solid. The
yeah.
other thing is, hasn't Buddha himself said that Shraddha, what is that? Shraddha, which is faith.
Yeah.
Arouses on sorrow and lamentation?
Oh, well, there is a statement that comes in one sutta that suffering is the supporting condition for faith. And keep it concise because I want to try to get to it.
Attachment to form
yeah.
leads to attachment to delusion
yeah.
and suffering. So he's making the traditional
Yeah, this is a traditional Buddhist statement. You're wrong, you want?
I think the question you asked is what we were thinking when we read that passage. And what I was thinking is that what a waste. Why couldn't the venerable just tell the householder or his father to give the money to the poor? So it must be that he sees gold coins or wealth as absolute evil. No, whoever gets it is bad. Otherwise, why wouldn't you just give it to people who need it and then go
yeah.
and turn it into a good thing?
Yeah.
I don't think he's focused on the gold. I think he is seeing, by now he can see,
yeah.
that attachment to wealth and greed is producing suffering in his father.
Yeah, okay, that's a good way.
It's advice, it is just for
him. Yeah, yeah. Okay, what? Oh, Clement, you want to say something?
I thought about impermanence.
Yeah. Yeah, of course the wealth is impermanent. But I had something else in mind. I would think that Ratapala should have, well, this is my conception, sort of gently told the father that know, I've become a monk, I've given up concern with gold and silver, it's not something that I'm involved with, but we're following the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha, and if you want to find happiness, of course you can keep the wealth and do meritorious deeds with it, but you should also recognize the impermanence of wealth, and while living it, the household life with wealth, you can do meritorious deeds. You don't have to ask me to do them. But you should also recognize that all of these things are impermanent, the enjoyments they bring are impermanent, and so you should also practice the same path that I'm practicing to liberation. You know, rather than make a rather provocative statement like that, which is sort of a little bit painful to the heart, to speak gently and compassionately to the Father and try to awaken good seeds within his mind. Okay, maybe we'll stop at this point and then we'll continue. We'll have discussion period after the lunch break and then we'll continue with the sutta next week. Next week is 20 September 22nd. Okay, so we'll come back about 12:10, 12:15 to have a little discussion. And now we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Mamparam Eta vata chaham pehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Eta vata chaham pehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Eta vata chaham pehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe sadano modantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavad upadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, we could stand. And then we end with the three half bows to the Buddha.
Out of the bathroom.